The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I am Stephanie Contouris with Dave Willingham and Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson. Tonight, guest host Galen Hertz, who is the co-founder of the Bellingham Tenants Union. We are going to get to that, income discrimination and the city of Bellingham, possible ordinance ahead, tenants' rights, how housing and the environment intersect, and a huge breaking story from our favorite Fergie, Attorney General Ferguson. But first, just a quick reminder. We have raised $6,000 KMRE, a little bit more than that. We need to have $10,000 if you care about the show. I imagine if you tuned in at the top of the show that you probably do care and you really like shows like Cascadia News Now, where we have discussions and dialogue that you literally cannot get anywhere else in Bellingham and Whatcom County. Please help us get over the hump, help us become solvent and get a new location so that we can keep bringing you fantastic programming, including us, Community Voice from community to community, friends and relatives from the Lummi Nation, and a whole lot more. Again, go to savekmre.org, savekmre.org, even $5 makes a huge difference. That's what community radio is about. A quick shout out and thank you to Tony Carpenter, Mike Genunzio, Doug Starcher, Matt Benoit, Brooks Collins, and Dave and Galen, who are sitting in this room. Thanks, you guys, for pitching in. It really means a lot. Okay, without further ado, let us get into the big story of the week. Attorney General Bob Ferguson has filed a lawsuit against the national hotel chain Motel 6. The AG accused Motel 6 of voluntarily and routinely providing guest lists to agents of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, that's ICE. At least 2 years this has been happening, and this investigation followed news that Motel 6 had delivered the same kind of information, releasing information about names and identities of guests without a warrant in Arizona. Each time Motel 6 released a guest list, it included names and private information of every guest at the hotel. The chain in Washington has admitted that at least six hotels in our state voluntarily gave ICE private information on its guests, numbering over 9,000. And actually, the thing about that is that the AG's office actually believes that that's what we know, and they suspect that thousands more may have had their information compromised. Bob Ferguson, our attorney general, says that Motel 6 knew ICE used its guest list to target customers based on national origin, including customers with Latino-sounding names. They had no warrant.
Yeah, and this is particularly disgusting. The breakdown in the press conference where they were talking about how at least at the South Everett Motel 6 location, ICE agents were coming in almost every day, early in the morning, late at night, looking through the list, circling the Hispanic names, and going out to their car to look them up. And that is so awful. There is no way that anyone who considers the history of this country and what it's supposed to be about can think that this is even remotely okay. This is straight up disgusting, and I'm really glad that our attorney general is stepping up.
Hold up. So you're going on a certain assumption that we all know and understand what we believe in this country. But there might be some who would say, oh, well, this is good because we're going after people who are doing something illegal.
Well, I would strongly recommend that the people who feel that way take a look at the Declaration of Independence. And among the grievances in there were acts like this, where people were considered guilty and people were being harassed by the big tyrannical government. The thing that is mind-blowing to me is that this was voluntary. You know, there are cases where, you know, there are courts that decide on, you know, grounds that I don't necessarily agree with, that companies have to release data to federal agencies, and that's one thing. This was this company stepping up and saying, we are going to collaborate with this agency of the government and totally disregard the privacy rights of our customers in pursuit of what I can only imagine is, you know, a personal political end of, you know, management at that company.
Yeah, I guess how I would, you know, we have a lot of concerns in this country about the surveillance state. I mean, you know, people on the right call it the deep state. That same group of people have deep concerns about the overreach of government and government intrusion into private lives, government intrusion into people's private affairs. And so how can that be supported within that realm? On the left, I would say that it's pretty obvious that this is a civil liberties crisis, you know, where our very identities are for barter between private business and the government for law enforcement purposes, and you know who knows what the information is used for, because the limitations and the guarantees are just not there about how that information has been used.
I think that this news that it's I think the Motel 6 story, when it first broke, it was in Arizona. And the news that it's here in Washington just raises a lot of questions for me. Was this across the nation? Was the decision made by Motel 6 at
right.
A national
it's
level?
It's my understanding that our Attorney General, our hero Bob Fergie, yeah. started researching it because of that story in Arizona.
Yep. I'm wondering, you know, are other motel chains, and how many other institutions, not even motel chains, just any institution where you give them your private information, how widespread is this?
Right. Well, I would say also that this was a cagey move by our state attorney general, because he has been on about a lot of immigration issues and about a lot of civil rights issues and a lot of consumer protection things. And these almost seem to come together in a nexus there of things that he's already been involved in. And I think that the attorney general is a pretty smart guy. There is an immigration case that's going to come before the Supreme Court, I think, this year regarding some overreach by the Trump administration. And this, I think, is a method by which he can feed into that. He can probably get some kind of legal discovery as a result of it and strengthen the state's case to push back against the overreach of ICE and immigration law in Washington State.
Well, Tim, what you say is cagey. I would call strategic.
Yes.
But that's because, to me, Bob Ferguson is a hero and he can do no wrong and he walks on water. And I refuse to hear the word cagey next to his name, at least so far. But that's just me and my own love. I did want to point out, Galen, you brought something up about how this could be any institution. And I think that's an excellent question we should be asking. One of the things about this Motel 6 incident in Arizona, or repeated incidents of targeting people of color and people with Latino-sounding names, is that Motel 6's own privacy policy assures consumers that their information would be protected.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, to expand on that a little bit more on what you were saying, Galen, part of why I'm glad that the Attorney General is taking this step and taking it now and as dramatically as they are, is that I want the idea of doing this to be totally unacceptable to any other company or agency. I want them to be afraid what happens if people find out we did this, because it's not my hotel's business what my immigration status is. It's not, you know, their
or my
business.
Rental car or anything. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It doesn't have anything to do with the business we are conducting. And we are creeping further and further. I'm not going to go all the way down this road.
Come
We're
on,
creeping further and further into a, you know, place where everything we do is being recorded, is being tracked, is being watched, is being associated with all of our other data. And it's bad enough that that's online. God help us if that follows us into, you know, real space here.
Can I just insert that Dave, the man that you're just listening to, Dave Willingham, works in internet security and internet technology. And so for me to hear, I mean, I'm on the conspiracy side of life, but for me to hear somebody who works in the field is a pro-technology guy talking about this warning, I think that's huge.
Yeah, I think the question comes down to, you know, even among people who, you know, want our borders to be secure, what are you willing to, what parts of your life and the things that you consider to be rights are you willing to just arbitrarily surrender to that goal? I mean, there are other goals as well in our society, and they all these things need to be kept in a perspective, and there needs to be some oversight, and obviously there is no oversight here. If a company decides that it wants to provide information to ICE and ICE is willing to get it, is that a sufficient threshold, or is there more involved with our private records and our personal liberties?
We just had, you know, in the last decade, we had a number of repeated fights on the national level against bills like SESTA, which would have encouraged internet companies to hand over personal information to the government so the government wouldn't have to go through this whole warrant thing. You know, we keep having these fights over and over again. And again, you know, I hope that, you know, Motel 6 and their 25 locations or whatever in Washington State gets hit really hard for this, because this has to be unacceptable to us.
Well, and I worry. I think that I saw some. I mean, this just broke before we came on the air, but the outrage that I saw once again started in communities of color, communities that are immigrant rights focused. The issues that you are all bringing up are that these are issues for every American, for every person. Whatever your documentation is, who resides in this country right now, I think there is a challenge in getting people who are not targeted or whose families are not targeted to care as deeply.
Well, I think that that's very true. And, you know, we saw that with the fight against, like, stop and frisk in New York, where people who were not stopped repeatedly and searched by police didn't feel the same sense of urgency around it. And, you know, I can understand people sitting at home thinking, well, I don't go to Motel 6. Why does this bother me? But this is the sort of, this is a canary situation. We caught this time.
So Bob Ferguson, our attorney general, has been arguing that each time Motel 6 disclosed each guest's name and information qualifies as a separate violation of the Consumer Protection Act, and the office is asking for civil penalties of up to $2,000 per violation. Maybe this will shut down Motel 6, and if that's the case, that could be the warning system that you are hoping for, Dave. I would really encourage our listeners to tune in to Community Voice, which airs Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursdays on our station. Please look it up on KMRE.org for the specific times, but I know that they'll be talking about this from a much different perspective than the people who are sitting around this table right now. We are going to be right back as soon as we talk about more stuff that we love about our Attorney General on Cascadia News Now, right after this.
Create, share, education. We enliven the rich history, legacies, stories, and historical traditions of the Salish people. We endeavor to create understanding and change perceptions across cultural differences, share history, and educate others. We are dedicated to marketing Native American-themed performance arts, as well as making the culture and the history of Native American people accessible. Drawing upon long family traditions, the children of the Setting Sun Productions, multimedia film and theater arts, specializing in Coast Salish storytelling. You will find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, or settingsunproductions.org. Heishka.
KMRE is your community voice. For over a decade, we brought you volunteer-powered, locally produced radio programming. As one of the few nonprofit radio stations in Bellingham, we bring quality broadcasting, diverse voices, and compelling ideas to the airwaves. Programming you'll not hear anywhere else. We need your help. KMRE needs a new home. Help us save our broadcast license and become fully independent. If local media is important to you, now is the time to keep KMRE alive. Please visit SaveKMRE.org to donate now. Again, please go to SaveKMRE.org and keep community radio strong. Thank you.
Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and our guest host tonight, Galen Hertz, will be talking about the Bellingham Tenants Union and a lot of local municipal stuff coming up. But first, we were talking about my hero, Bob Ferguson, our Attorney General, and Motel 6. Something we haven't had a chance to talk about on the show is him taking on net neutrality in light of the FCC recent vote. And I want to direct people also to read Tim Johnson's excellent gristle in this week's Cascadia Weekly. It's free. It's available online. And it's a really great summation. But if you are just listening now and you have no idea what net neutrality is and no pop-ups have ever come up when you're searching the internet alerting you and screaming about what's going to happen to all of us, Dave, do you want to give us a little recap?
Sure. So net neutrality at its, the most simplified version of it is that the internet access provider, the people who sit between you and the service you want to use, that's Comcast, CenturyLink, different parts of
Pogo
the country,
zone.
Yeah, railroad, wherever you are, that they will do nothing more than take the packets from you to the backbone and from the backbone to the service provider and back without interference, without looking at them. And this is based on the concept of a common carrier, which goes back into English common law and briefly was a situation where certain transport agencies and later railroads would be classified as common carriers. And the idea was that they couldn't refuse service to anybody. If they offered a transport service, they had to offer it to everybody. And in exchange, they got protection. Like if they transported illegal goods, well, they didn't know because they're common. They don't look at it. They just move it. So we don't really have net neutrality in its purest form in this country. But over the course of the Obama administration, we got closer than we had in the past to enshrining that in policy. And just last month, the FCC voted on a new rule that would not only eliminate that, but it would also prevent states from enacting their own strict net neutrality policies. Now, that's not final yet. The final order has not yet been written. Once it's written, it'll get voted on again and then added to the Federal Register and then take effect 60 days after that. So we're in a little bit of a holding pattern, but that's kind of where we are right now.
Yeah, I guess I'd put it maybe even a little more blunt, Dave. The situation that we maybe have in this country right now is that these service providers can't put their hands around your throat. And the situation that we're looking at down the road is everybody has hands around their throat unless they pay money to the provider not to have hands around their throat. So it's a throttling kind of issue where
literally, according to you.
Yes, the providers, they wanted this. They say, oh, well, we have no interest in throttling anything. It's like, well, then why do you want it if you have no proposal or any thought that there might be a way to glean some profit? And I think the one thing that people don't understand about it is this is not an issue that is going to make internet service better or faster or cheaper or anything. It just is going to create a profit center for those companies to throttle their content unless you pay the money that it's so that it's not throttled.
And can create – oh, go ahead, Galen.
Yeah, I think you're also looking at the suppression of free speech because for smaller websites, KRMRE.org, maybe that'll be much slower service and only Facebook or eBay or Amazon has faster service. So you're looking at smaller local independent websites not being able to use them as much.
And we have heard from some of these big people like Comcast or some of the big companies protesting that that would never happen. But Dave, that has happened already.
That has happened. And the soft version of net neutrality violation is what's called zero rating. And we've seen a lot of that. And what that is if you say, okay, if you go to Google Plus, you'll get fast speed. But if you go to Facebook, you get slow speed. And nobody wants that. And, we see it with mobile where T-Mobile will say, if you go to this website, it doesn't count against your data plan. If you go to this website, it does count against your data plan. And so we've already seen that. We've seen...
But that was sort of halted, wasn't it?
No, that has been acceptable so long as they have been upfront about it. But expect to see more of that. And we've seen things like Comcast blocking certain types of internet traffic. We've seen Verizon specifically slowing and outlawing things. AT&T got busted for banning Apple's FaceTime video chat app. It's been a problem and is going to become a problem.
And what happens when a company like Netflix gets in a spat or a contract dispute with Comcast, so that Comcast no longer feels required or in any sense to stream Netflix?
They can actually deny it entirely.
Correct.
And that's happened. That, you know, there was a case with Netflix and Comcast and Verizon where they wanted Netflix to pay for special peering agreements, and Netflix said no, and finally Netflix said yes, and Netflix works much better on those networks now.
Okay, so getting back to my hero, Attorney General Bob Ferguson. How does Attorney General Bob Ferguson fit into this? So he asked the FCC to delay their vote before they voted. They did not. And then he said he was going to file a legal challenge to the FCC's decision. He said to allow internet service providers to discriminate based on content undermines a free and open internet. And he said FCC's action will seriously harm consumers, innovation, and small business. Going back to the gristle, Tim Johnson reported that the FCC included language in its repeal that prohibits states and local governments from establishing their own protections. So this is going to be a really interesting case. I know that he is working with Governor Inslee and with our own Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission. We will get into that more at a later date, but go read Tim Johnson's gristle. We have just a few minutes left in this half hour to get into what's ahead for us legislatively in Olympia and for our state. Take it away, Deb.
So Monday is first day of a new session. It's a short session because it's an even year, and they have a lot of stuff on the docket already. The pre-filed bills, there's a ton of them. I want to start right at the top and say congratulations to Keith Wagner, former mayor of Cedro Woolley, who was just appointed to fill out the rest of Kirk Pearson's term in the 39th. Kirk Pearson took a job with the Department of Agriculture. And
term as what?
I'm sorry?
Kirk Pearson was a what?
Was a state senator from the 39th district.
Which is where?
East Skagit, East Snohomish, little bit of Northeast King County, big but remarkably similar across all of it district. So that brings, you know, we're going to start off the session strong with 49 senators, and you know, the big things to look for that I've been watching are the Disclose Act, which will close a loophole where you will have a political organization, a PAC like, say, Fuse Washington, which is a liberal PAC here in Washington State, and there are limits on the money that they can receive and the money they can spend, and there's a lot of disclosure requirements, but they have a sister nonprofit that doesn't have those disclosure requirements, and we've seen over the last couple of years these nonprofits raise a bunch of money, then give that money to the PAC, and nobody knows where that money came from. So look for that to close. There's a loophole in port races where if you are running for port commissioner for a locality that has fewer than 200,000 citizens, there are no campaign finance limits whatsoever. And we just saw in a Port of Vancouver race, candidates raise more than $1 million apiece.
Wow. And Port of Vancouver.
Port of Vancouver. And it was a huge referendum on the oil terminal there, and we've talked about that. But that's going to happen. There's a couple of bills that would ban Atlantic salmon from Puget Sound entirely.
And that references the spill that dumped a mess of Atlantic salmon in and screwed up our environment. It screwed up the Lummi's livelihood.
And Galen? What are you looking at?
Yeah. On housing, there's a lot in Olympia this session. Pretty historic. Their representative, Nicole Macri, she has introduced a bill to overturn the statewide ban on rent control. That ban was put in place by the landlord lobby in 1980, and there hasn't been any discussion about it in Olympia since 1999.
Wow.
So this is pretty big and prompted by Seattle's housing crisis, which is not just in Seattle. It's all up and down the I-5 corridor.
And because we're not in California, and some people may not be familiar with what rent control does, do you want to give a brief?
Sure. There's a lot of different forms. Sometimes it's called rent stabilization. Usually limits the amount of percentage rent increase that a landlord can do. So maybe they can keep up with inflation or repairs, but they can't just, you know, in a housing shortage, up the rent 30%, which is essentially economically evicting low-income tenants and leading to homelessness and displacement. So that's a big thing. Nicole, when she talks about it, she wants people to keep in mind that usually all sorts of tenant protections are multi-year long fights. So it's good to, you know, voice your support for this to legislators, but it's probably going to be many years down the road. There's also seeming very likely this session a statewide ban on source of income discrimination, which I know we'll be talking about later. There's a bill or a ordinance being prepared here in Bellingham, but that source of income discrimination is the practice where landlords can, in many places, legally discriminate against people if they have housing assistance. So like Section 8 vouchers, veteran-assisted housing, and it's discrimination against the most vulnerable in our community and across the state. So that's very likely to go
through. And just a reminder that Galen Hertz did co-found the Bellingham Tenants Union, and that's why we're going to get into it in the second half. So I know that you've got a lot of background on that.
And popping really quick to higher education, I just graduated from Western.
Woohoo!
And I was part of the lobby days that happen every year where a bunch of students go down and we lobby to make sure that higher education is accessible to all students regardless of your income or background here in Washington. Two big issues. One is that we're looking to somehow alter the DREAM Act here in Washington, because that's dependent on a student having DACA. But if Trump and Congress get rid of DACA, that would mean that a lot of undocumented students are left completely
unprotected. And I'm going to back you up and make you explain all of that just briefly for people who haven't been listening to our show every week.
Okay.
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
I am by no means very knowledgeable about this. I think DACA is a program that gives certain protections to undocumented young people who came into this country at a young age, and it's been crucial for students to attend university. I think it helps with getting jobs. I don't fully understand it, but Trump has repeatedly said that he wants to get rid of it, and not clear how that's going to happen. I don't know anybody else.
It's going to require, at the federal level anyway, an effort by Congress. Congress is going to have to get together and do something. You know, probably the most likely thing that Congress will do is they will probably hammer out an agreement at the end, after all of the squabbling and squawking. They will hammer out agreement that they get more money for border enforcement, and at the same time as they get an extension to DACA. So I think that's what probably is going to happen, or it could actually just collapse in a big mess, a big huge mess.
When I'm very excited for this session because I feel like this might be the grown-up session. This might be the session where they get what they're supposed to get done
and
early.
Actually move forward.
Because we have a Democratic majority in both houses. Is that why?
Just because we have unitary government, so that there will be less incentive for people to drag their feet.
I'm actually not as optimistic as you are about that, Dave. I think that one of the things that they will definitely try to do is they will try to hammer out some kind of carbon pricing agreement. I don't know that they have the numbers or the will to get a lot done, but the one thing I will predict that they will do is there's a lot of nonsense bills that were put out there that are kind of half alive out there, and
which
I think those are going to be swept. Those are going to be swept away, and a lot of those come from ALEC, the legislative right wing legislative group that put.
You're talking about
forward.
Things like the bathroom bill.
Bathroom bill. Let's get rid of gay marriage. These kinds of things. These are bills that are actually there. They're alive, and they need to be swept away.
Yeah. Well, time will tell. You know, I think the criteria for victory that I see for the Democrats now that they have control of the state government is, can they take the painful things off the board right away? Can they get rid of can they fix the Hearst situation? Can they get a capital budget passed? Can they actually make some progress in this direction before they all have to break for an election.
Yeah, and I just want to emphasize how crucial it is that that capital budget gets passed soon. There's a lot of money in there, millions and millions of dollars for affordable housing development. And if it's not passed soon, all these projects that rely on our state funding, but also our national federal funding, the low-income housing tax credit. So if they don't get that funding from the state, then they're going to lose their project and that housing's going to go away. It's not going to get built.
And we're going to be paying attention to that as the legislative session starts and throughout the session, as long as KMRE stays alive. Make that happen. SaveKMRE.org. Did you see what I did there? You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ in Deming, Van Zandt. This is Cascadia News Now. Our guest tonight is Galen Hertz, who you just heard. Galen Hertz is the co-founder of the Bellingham Tenants Union. He was involved previously in the movement to defeat the Cherry Point coal export terminal. Galen was subsequently involved in fossil fuel divestment campaign at Western, where he just graduated, and he is now working with the Bellingham Tenants Union, whose mission is to ensure residents have access to a safe, secure, and affordable home. Galen, thank you so much for the work you're doing in our city.
Thank you for having me.
And this ties in so excellently with another article that was in the weekly that just came out this week from our Bellingham councilman, Dan Hamill. His article stated that right now it's legal in Bellingham for landlords to discriminate against potential renters, and that's based solely on their source of income. What this is known as in the field is source of income discrimination, or SOID. I hope nobody tries to say that as a word. This practice, says Councilman Hamill, has been banned in 10 other Washington state jurisdictions and 14 other states. He says that closing this loophole is now being considered by the Bellingham City Council. And he also noted some statistics that I think play into a lot of things Galen is working on. He says from the Washington Department of Commerce notes that when rents go up by $100 a month in a community, homelessness goes up between 6% and 32%.
Yep. Yeah. It's
go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Just with the source of income discrimination ordinance, it was one of our very first priorities with the Bellingham Tenants Union. We saw, talking with other organizations around the state, that it has been banned in many other places. And we also did a lot of door knocking, talking to tenants at the door, and going out into the community, and we heard from tenants that have housing assistance that they applied many places and they couldn't get in. We're just sometimes when they were searching for housing on Craigslist, you'll just see no housing assistance, no Section 8. And that is just extremely demoralizing for people who are trying to find housing. And it's hard enough when we have extremely low vacancy rates in this city that are allowing for landlords to increase the rent so much. And I think this is a very good first step. Honestly, I would have loved to see the city council pass a ban on this many years ago, as so many other cities have. I think they're kind of late to the game, but I'm very impressed with Councilmember Hamill and also Councilmember Barker. They've been taking the lead on this ordinance, and it should be, from everything that I can tell, there's been a lot of support in the community for it. The landlords don't seem to be fighting it that much, which is, they've
amazing.
Just been kind of quietish on it. So that's a good sign, and I hope that this ordinance gets passed in January.
Right. Galen, I think you're drilling right to the core of it. When people talk about blah, blah, discrimination based on source of income, it's really important to focus on how that targets people who are Section 8, people who have vouchers, people who are seniors, people who are dependent on Social Security income, and all the other kinds of discrimination that covers.
Well, I guess what I would say is that the important operative words in there are source of income. You know, a landlord has the right to say, well, you know, what's your monthly income? Mm-hmm. It's irrelevant what the source of the income is. And that's what, when you say no Section 8 housing, you're making a definitive ruling that certain sources of income will not be considered by you. And you know, I think that the position of city council is that kind of consideration is irrelevant. I mean, they Do you have enough income to pay your rent? Yes, that's a consideration that a landlord may have a right to ask. Where does it come from? Who cares?
Yeah, and not, I mean, I've been in my life at various points, and I'm very grateful that I'm not now. I have been eligible for housing assistance, and I have always been terrified of heading down that road because then I'm locked in. Then I can live in these buildings, in these neighborhoods, and that's it. And that's awful. That you're taking people and you are
you're segregating them.
Yeah, you're segregating
you're
them,
you
and you're ghettoizing your own city.
Yeah.
It makes zero sense. And you know, one of the big struggles that we've had over the last 50 years in this country is where do people get to live? Can you move into any neighborhood that you can afford to live in? And I'm glad that you're working on this, Galen. I'm sad that you have to.
Yeah, but I would say that it's a much more complicated and difficult problem than just passing an ordinance because now a business can't say no Section 8, but that doesn't mean that they can't internally use Section 8 as a reason to not to consider an application. I mean, some of the testimony that came about at City Council was that, we got all these Section 8 applications, and we just threw them away. Now we're going to consider them, but we're going to consider them in the context of a bunch of other applications. And so it doesn't, just because you have a law now that says that they can't put no Section 8 in an ad on Craigslist, doesn't mean that they're not going to internally.
But that's true of racial discrimination. That's
correct.
True of every discrimination. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the ordinance.
And I think when it comes to racial discrimination based on gender or source of income, what really matters is enforcement. And from what I heard from City Council, they've been, I think, a little obscure about enforcement. They say, oh, we're going to partner with some, nonprofits or, oh, it'll be, but they haven't laid out a very specific plan about how they're going to, comb through and make sure that this discrimination isn't happening. And I think enforcement is really the key if this ordinance is going to be successful.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head.
Right? Yes. What you can't see on Radio Lit, but that, I think, speaks to why it is so important to be working on it on the state level at the same time that you're working on it, because we don't have the muscle to enforce that. Yes, it's a good step, but I think you're right, Tim, that it could be a weak step.
And I want to segue this into another big goal of the Tenants Union, is to have more available housing in Bellingham. Part of the reason why we're seeing so much more source of income discrimination is because we have such low vacancy rates right now, and that gives all the power in this situation to landlords. When they get 40 applications for a place in the first day, that means they have all the power to choose only their stereotypically ideal tenant, and tends to leave out the most vulnerable in our community, the most oppressed.
Well, and it's just to say yes and build on that. We also live in a city that is pretty heavily dominated by a few rental companies. And, it's kind of scary to think that, oh, if I get, blacklisted by these companies, I can't live anywhere in this town.
Right. Well, that was my question to you, Galen, was that, this source of income discrimination ordinance, that's just one thing in a much larger package of things. What other things would you like to see City Council tackle in terms of city policy regarding, that supports tenants and tenant rights?
Well, that's an excellent question. I do want to, before we get off of the source of income, I just wanted to point one quick thing out, and that is when we think of these people have Section 8, these people have a quote-unquote real income, or however people are thinking about it. One thing that is not being mentioned enough is the vouchers for Section 8 housing are temporary. And when you have, as Tim just mentioned, as Galen just mentioned, when you have such a difficult time getting a rental at all, no matter who you are in Bellingham, when you are issued a voucher that is a temporary voucher and you're desperate, that you're also under the gun, and then when that expires, do you go back to the end of the list? So
yeah.
I wanted to throw that out because I don't know that everybody gets
it's
that.
It's a very precarious situation, and I think puts a lot of stress on people's mental health to be in that situation. Totally agree.
Yeah. So back to Tim's.
Well, that was my question. That is just one issue of many, many issues that the tenants union has brought to the council's attention. What other things do they need to work on this year?
Right. So when we've gone into the community and talked with tenants and listened to all the, you know, comments that we get on our Facebook and other places, the biggest one is that there is just a lack of affordable housing in Bellingham, and the rent is too damn high. And a big part of this, and the reason why rent is continuing to increase so much, is because we have a shortage of housing. And barring rent control or rent stabilization, which I think we do need some form of, but that's going to be, you know,
years,
a huge fight to make that happen. So one of the, from all the research that I've done and talking with various community members, is that if we have more available housing, it shifts that power back to tenants, because when there's such a scarce amount of housing, tenants are forced to bid against each other for the available housing. And that allows these landlords to raise the rent,
right,
$200, $300, you know, $400 at a time. So having more available housing, and how do we make that happen in Bellingham? It's difficult for a number of reasons. One of the biggest that I know of is that the cost of construction is really high right now. You have Seattle, which is booming, having tons of people moving there because of Amazon and their tech boom. And all that construction is driving up the price of construction. It's very hard in Bellingham for that. Another big reason is that we have very restrictive zoning laws. In the available residential land in Bellingham, 70% is zoned single family. And in a lot of our neighborhoods, I live in the lettered streets. And Stephanie does too, that's right. I think I first met you. We have a lot of duplexes. We have a lot of triplexes. We have some little backyard cottages here and there that you couldn't build today because of the zoning laws. Those areas have been downzoned. And duplexes and those types of homes, sometimes it's called the missing middle, they provide a more affordable option for a lot of people. And we've made those housing forms not allowed in so much of our city.
Well, I think this also circles back to something you said, Dave. I mean, one of the issues, too, is that unlike Seattle, Bellingham has like a very small universe of rental agencies. I mean, it's a pretty close family. And I remember an article I read in the Bellingham Herald a few years ago that basically said, you know, one rental company said, well, you know, a rental company raised the rent, so we did too, and everybody did. Everybody raised it, and there wasn't any market reason to do that. It's just, it's a small world, it's a small family, and that's a problem too, because that creates an inelastic rental market.
Yeah, and I think that the only way we're going to break out of that is, you know, like you were saying, Galen, we need to diversify the type of rental properties that we have so that it's possible for people to say, you know, now I have this structure on my land and I'm going to rent that to people. And, you know, people don't have to be like me and be afraid to, you know, call up Landmark to get your deposit back because they won't give it to you because they don't feel like they have to.
Absolutely. One of the questions that comes to my mind, boy, we have talked so much about zoning, and I know we're going to keep talking about zoning and accessory dwelling units, and all of this is coming up for your group, Galen, for the Planning Commission. It's just, we're on the verge of this big mess. And one of the pieces of resistance of the NIMBY not in my backyard people seems like it might be the same kind of resistance to the type of income, in that people don't want multi-zones in their neighborhood because of character, or they don't want SS8 or Section 8 people next to them because of their prejudices. And how does the tenants union even take on that whole attitude that our city has? Or parts of our city, or people in our city.
Yeah.
I don't say our whole city,
it's a tough one. I think what gives me hope is that it's not just the tenants' union that wants to look at promoting housing choice. Some of the biggest people that I've talked to, and kind of where I started my organizing political work, is in the environmental movement. And from talking with environmentalists, they recognize that housing is an issue of climate justice and protecting our climate. If housing is so unaffordable in Bellingham that all these people are buying homes in Ferndale, or people are now renting in Kendall or Skagit and commuting to work every day, driving more emissions, that is not meeting our city's climate goals and our duty to future generations. And environmentalists also recognize when you can have backyard cottages or duplexes close to where people work or have more amenities that come from more people living in a neighborhood, that means people are less likely to drive their cars. They can walk places. They can have a low carbon lifestyle. And I think it's so crucial that we make sure that Bellingham is not a city for the rich. It's not just a playground for wealthy outdoor enthusiasts. And it really is inclusive to all people. And I think having affordable housing and housing choice is a huge part of that.
And makes a vibrant city. It makes a more livable city for everyone, I think is the point to get across. That was Galen Hertz. He is the co-founder of the Bellingham Tenants Union on Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris, and also here, Dave Willingham and Tim Johnson. I was looking at the list of agenda that the tenants union has, and we talked about source of income. You've talked about, or the Bellingham Tenants Union wants a cap in move-in fees and application costs. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Again, when we did our survey and knocking at the doors, we heard from people that they had to rent in motels, paying, you know, exorbitant. That can be, you know, just a huge cost sack. But that was because they didn't have that large upfront amount to get into housing with your first month's rent, like last month's rent deposit, can be, you know, multiple thousands of dollars sometimes. And we were inspired by looking at Seattle. Seattle has a huge housing crisis, but they also, partly because of that, they have a very strong tenants movement in that city. And council member Shama Sawant there has introduced a number of strong tenant protections, including allowing people to pay their deposit, their first month's rent, last month's rent in installments. You know, just like you go to buy a car or something, you usually can do installments or something. Same thing applies for housing so that people of lower incomes can have a safe home.
If a landlord demands first month's, last month's deposit, that's thousands of dollars.
Yep, upfront. It can be very difficult for people.
Prohibitive.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't... I'm not sure. Maybe you can enlighten us, Galen. I'm not sure what the limits of city government are on some of these issues because that's kind of a business policy. Is there something that government can do to address that?
I don't know. It's a great question. I know Seattle, they actually have like a lawsuit against them from a landlord organization over this, and they haven't been able to implement it yet. So it's a great question. I think we can kind of look to see what happens there and in other cities around the country, look at different tenant protections and see what we can do here in Bellingham.
Dave, why do I feel like you might have an opinion on that question?
it just makes me very happy to be near Seattle but not in Seattle so that they can try all of these things, spend a ton of civic money fighting it out in courts, and when it's over, it's like, oh, well, I guess we can't do that, or I guess we can.
They do the R&D.
Uh-huh.
Okay. This is speaking of Seattle, and again, Shama Sawant, this is pretty exciting policy that she is preparing to – they're drafting the ordinance right now. But what it does is it is an ordinance to prevent economic evictions – by if the landlord raises the policy works, if a landlord raises the rent by more than 10% on somebody making less than $50,000 a year, they have to provide that tenant 3 months of rent.
Wow. Heck yeah, that's me. Yeah. I qualify for that.
And it's partially because in Seattle in 1990, they passed an ordinance that if the landlord was evicting a tenant due to remodeling or selling the building or something, they had to provide some financial assistance to that tenant to move. And the same idea is here. If landlords are going to economically evict tenants because of these massive rent increases, then they should help out and with that tenant finding a new place, or don't evict them.
That sounds like, and I don't mean this to be a pejorative way of putting it, but that sounds a little bit like rent control. That's one of the things that happened in places like New York, where, you know, you only saw a rent increase when somebody moved out. I mean, mm-hmm. and so if you lived in an apartment or for a number of years, you might maybe the rent could go up by the cost of inflation, but you know, it would be controlled for that tenant as long as that tenant lived there. So. That sounds a little bit like that, but maybe not quite as severe as that.
The side door.
I also say with rent control, it's definitely not a silver bullet. So California, a number of cities there have rent control, including San Francisco.
San Francisco is just
San Francisco is also the you know, the epitome of a housing crisis.
Yes.
Where their rents are like $6,000 a month or something, and huge displacement of low-income people of color from that city. So, and in San Francisco, a huge part of that is because of their not-in-my-backyard attitudes, and they have blocked so many new projects for housing where people could live and have more spaces in that city for all the, you know, wealthy people moving there. And same goes in Seattle. When you have these tech booms and lots of wealthy people move in, if there aren't new homes or more homes for those people to move into, they just compete against the existing lower income residents, and those people get pushed out. And those people in Seattle, especially, it's, you know, predominantly communities of color that have been displaced from that city, and it's awful.
And do we stand to be in line for that tech boom issue, Bellingham?
I don't know. That's
well. I think we're. I think Bellingham is in the midst of some crisis right now, where it has become identified as a place where people want to live and to particularly retire, and that's put a lot of pressure on the rental market in Bellingham. As has, I think, the success of Western Washington University. They've increased their enrollment quite a bit, and they've not provided, the university itself has not provided housing for that.
And nobody's denying the current situation. I guess my question is, looking south along the I-5 corridor, looking at Seattle, looking at San Francisco, are we also in line to fall to that tech boom situation, which would exacerbate every situation, every aspect that we're in now?
I don't know about that. I want to Tim's question. I get that a lot out in the community. That some people call it the elephant in the room, Western. So I did some research into this, and I looked at Western's enrollment, and it increases exactly on par with the state's overall population growth. It's like 1.5% a year. So they're, I think, as an institution, they're meeting their duty as a public good to provide education to the whole state of Washington by keeping their enrollment up with the natural population growth. Why haven't they built more housing? Why haven't they built more dorms to take pressure off everybody else? Great question. I want them to. My defense of them is that they are under austerity, as are so many of our other public institutions.
What does that mean, they are under austerity?
Is they suffer from constant cuts and limited funding, underfunding. And case in point that I like to give is Carver Gym. We had a gym at Western, and it was seismically unstable. And this was identified like in the 90s. And it took decades, literally decades, of student lobbying and Western lobbying to finally get the funding to fix that building. Can you imagine if there had been an earthquake and there was a basketball game going in there? I can't imagine, you know, we shouldn't have seismically unstable sporting arenas on our campus. But that took decades to get the funding to fix. So I think, and they also are, I know that our faculty are some of the least compensated of all the different universities in the state. And so they have limited funding, and I think unless we at a state level have progressive taxation, capital gains tax, income tax, and can give them the money that they need to build housing, I can understand why they are doing what they have to do.
I guess if I can interpret what you're saying, our public policy is not growing at the same pace as our population.
Yes. Yep.
So one thing that is interesting about you, Galen, is that you're such a powerful advocate for housing and housing parity, but you didn't start off in housing. As I mentioned earlier, you started off in environment. And there's probably a connection there, but would you like to lead us through how you got from the coal trains to here and the coal port to here?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Austin, Texas. And when I was in middle school and high school, our state suffered two record-breaking droughts that our state climatologists testified were made worse by climate change. And I saw this impact. We had wildfires come within a mile of my home in Austin, saw our state's economy and ecosystems just devastated by this. So I understood at a young age that there's a very clear connection between having a safe climate and human well-being. And when I came up to Western, I pretty quickly got involved with some of the amazing environmental clubs on campus. I became a member of Students for Renewable Energy, and they were just kicking off the fossil fuel divestment campaign. Western has a foundation with millions of dollars, and some of that money is going to fossil fuel companies. So we identified this kind of contradiction where they're saying they're really environmentally friendly and they, you know, want to prepare us for the world, but they were investing in companies that are continually trying to block clean energy and promote even more fossil fuel extraction. And that has been a long journey, and it's still ongoing. There's been some great progress made for more sustainable investing, and it's this long process. But the club that I was a part of, Students for Renewable Energy, we also got involved in the community, working on campaigns for progressive county council members, supporting the Lummi Nation and their treaty rights against that huge proposed coal export terminal at Cherry Point. And I just learned a lot about local politics. And then I finally, I had this job where I was the student government's representative to the local government here. And that's when I really learned about housing, because students are affected by it. We have homeless students at Western that are living out of their cars. But it's not just an issue that affects Western students, clearly. It's a whole community. And I kind of just clicked the dots. If housing is so unaffordable here that people are commuting from towns far away and they have to use their cars, that's not good climate policy. That's not living up to our reputation as an environmentally progressive city. So I think having an affordable city and allowing for people to live close to where they work, and having our, you know, parks and all of our wonderful amenities accessible to families, being a truly welcoming city, that's crucial.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, the city has put together its policies under the Growth Management Act, and one of its policies is to build tight, walkable, livable communities. And so, again, the city's own policy says they need to address this.
Absolutely. I wanted to give you a chance, Galen. I noticed there was a couple of things coming up, January 21st and January 22nd, and it's okay if you don't have a lot of details, but it looked like on the Bellingham Tenants Union Facebook page, January 21st, there is a homeless summit, and January 22nd, the Tenants Union is urging people to come speak to City Council about homelessness and real solutions.
Yeah, we've been working with the Homes Now, Not Later folks, which have been really instrumental in working with the homeless community, not just assuming that they know best, but actually really forming relationships with those people and asking them what do they need, which is something that I think doesn't happen enough in Bellingham when it comes to the issue of homelessness. And people said, we need safe places to camp and not be pushed around from place to place around the city, being evicted. So that's something that they've brought to the city, and we want to support them in that. So that's that. Also, as far as having more available homes and more affordable homes, there's the Planning Commission public hearing on the backyard cottages and accessory dwelling units on Thursday, January 25th.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you can find out more if you're listening in your car and those dates just all ran by. I encourage you to go to the Bellingham Tenants Union on Facebook and find out a little bit more about how you can get involved in this ongoing issue. And Galen Hertz, you have been a fantastic guest host. Thank you so much. Also, Tim Johnson, and for your great gristle this week, and Dave Willingham. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris. And we want to also thank our amazing engineer, Devlin Sweeney, who works at Western and probably had a lot to say about this. So we'll get you on another time. But you can also hear him on American Carnage Report on Mondays at 9 and 5. And I would urge you to go to our own Facebook page, Cascadia News Now, or find our archive shows at cascadianewsnow.com. And finally, if you've been listening, and if this, I thought this was a really lively conversation, and I enjoyed it from my chair, but if you're enjoying it out there, please give a couple bucks. SaveKMRE.org. That is SaveKMRE.org to keep community conversations alive. This is KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.